Good morning. Welcome to Jays Talk Plus, Royals Talk Plus today. Big ol' assist from our Kansas City Royals yesterday as the Toronto Blue Jays had an off day but looked to keep the Seattle Mariners as far at arm's length as possible. If you were scoreboard watching yesterday, you would have noticed. If you weren't, we'll update you here. The Angels got blanked 12-0. They are more or less, I think, at this point, not a part of the wild card conversation. They are 7 games back with 3 teams to jump. For comparison's sake, the Jays would only have 1 team to jump, and they are 8.5 back in the division. So if you're feeling like the division's out of reach, then you should probably be feeling like the Angels' wild card chances are out of reach. It was a pretty good day for the Jays in terms of who is chasing them in the wild card. Rangers beat the Angels 12-0. The Braves beat the Yankees 11-3. Baltimore won, but I think at this point, you know, like we just kind of said, it's getting to be a long one here. Now, in Kansas City is where things were most fascinating because the Seattle Mariners entered play only 1.5 games back of the Blue Jays. Kansas City is certainly an opponent where you'd expect Seattle to be able to make up some ground. As it turns out, Brady Singer, of all people, takes a no-hitter into the 7th. He eventually gives it up. The Royals blow the lead entirely. They are 1 strike away from winning this thing in the 9th. It all unravels. Canadian and sleeper agent Matt Brash then takes the hill for the Mariners in the 9th. And wouldn't you know it, help from some old friends. Samad Taylor enters the game. And with a runner on 3rd, 1 out, Dairon Blanco lays down a sack bunt. And, well, not a sack bunt because it's the winning run. So you're probably not sacrificing there. It's more of a squeeze, I think we'd call it. And Samad Taylor gets home. We've seen Dairon Blanco lay that bunt down for Samad Taylor a couple times. It is a picture-perfect bunt up the first baseline. And Samad Taylor, who was moving on the play, scores. His 7th stolen base of the season came earlier in that inning as well. Samad Taylor, of course, the key piece in the Whit Merrifield trade. Platinum Max Castillo was also a part of that. He has been less effective for Kansas City. Samad Taylor, though, despite a 5.23 OPS, really nailing the Dalton Pompey role with 7 stolen bases, most of them as a pinch runner. So the Mariners lose. That's good for the Blue Jays. You obviously, you know, to hear Chris Bassitt tell it on the weekend, anytime you're looking at other teams, that's when things go wrong. You got to be focused on your own work, eyes on your own page. We are not the Toronto Blue Jays in that clubhouse, though, so we can continue to keep an eye on the standings. And on a day where the Toronto Blue Jays didn't play, they gained 0.5 game of extra edge over the Mariners, over the Yankees, over the Angels. Yes, they lost 0.5 game to Baltimore in the division chase, but what can you do? The most important thing at this point is securing a playoff spot. And realistically, if you're not going to sweep that Orioles series next week, you're not going to have much of a chance to come back in the division anyway. So maybe focus on doing your best work in the wild card scenarios. The Jays will start a 2-game set down at Rogers Center tonight against the Philadelphia Phillies. Zach Wheeler, Yusei Kikuchi tonight, Aaron Nola, Kevin Gausman tomorrow. We'll continue to tee that series up throughout the day. Fun show today. Chris Black's going to come on at 11 o'clock instead of his usual 10 o'clock Tuesday spot. Michael Bowman of Fangraphs, who is also a Phillies guy, just wrote a Yusei Kikuchi piece. We'll talk to him later in the show about both of those things. Jonathan Mayo of MLB Pipeline is going to come on. There's an updated top 100 prospects over at MLB.com and an updated internal top 30 for the Blue Jays. So we'll kick some of that around with him. But right now, we're joined by someone who's a part of a lot of ceremonies on the weekend, Caitlin McGrath of The Athletic. Jose Bautista ceremony or the wedding ceremony you went to, what stuck out more for you this weekend?
Yeah, I know. That was a big Saturday for me, just one ceremony to the next. You know, the Jose Bautista ceremony was really great. I kind of knew the Blue Jays had been working really hard on it. You know, sometimes our position as, you know, media being at games later the night before, you get to see some of the rehearsals and stuff like that that's happening. So I had a pretty good idea that they had some, you know, surprises up their sleeves and they had a lot planned. But seeing it actually, you know, happen, seeing all the players come back and the reaction to him and the, just the reaction, his reaction to everything, you know, it was really special. I thought it was really well done. I was kind of surprised how emotional he got. But then not really, because, you know, I do know that, like, I remember last year when, I think it was last year when Russell Martin, they had a ceremony for him too. And he beforehand was like, no, I don't think I'll cry. And then, like, immediately the video start playing and guys are saying lovely things about him and he starts to cry. So the same thing happened with Jose. And, you know, just seeing the name actually unveiled on the level of excellence, that was really cool too. Like, just that moment, everyone just kind of watching the same thing at the same time, and, you know, all the memories that are flowing through people's minds at that time. It was a cool ceremony. I'm glad I was there, and it was really well done.
I have to ask, not to be negative about a fun day, but my sources indicate, and I wasn't there because I also had wedding duties that day, Caitlin. My sources have told me that the Jose Bautista cookies, however, that were available in the media room were not up to the Jose Bautista level of excellence standard. Is that accurate reporting?
You know, there was mixed reactions to the cookies. I thought it was okay, but they were really sugary. I think that was the thing, that, you know, when, like, something's so sugary, it, like, almost hurts your teeth. It's kind of like that. But you know what? If for all that was maybe lacking in flavor and taste, the actual cookie looked great. So, you know, credit for that.
Well, that part is important, of course, the big number 19 on a cookie there. Okay, so Caitlin, before the Jose Bautista of it all on Saturday, we did get some news on Friday, and it was after this show, so we haven't really gotten a chance to talk about it much. I know you wrote about it for The Athletic. The big news Friday was Alek Manoah being optioned down to AAA. The Blue Jays, of course, wrap up their 17 games in 17 days stretch. We had talked about, of course, the Dan Schulman of it all, like, these things have a way to work themselves out. We thought maybe it had worked itself out with Hyunjin Ryu taking a comebacker off the knee. He ended up being fine and was excellent again on Sunday. The decision to option Alek Manoah down rather than try one of these six in the bullpen or phantom IL someone, what was your read on that? Did that catch you off guard Friday, or had that kind of been where you were leaning at that point?
It somewhat caught me off guard in the timing of it, because I guess they could have waited till today, realistically. But I think that they wanted the other arm in the bullpen. Makes sense, especially, like, using Ryu in that situation. Like, he was great, he was fine, but he hasn't exactly been pitching deep into games, probably purposefully, just given, you know, coming back and using him in the best possible way. And so, you know, it did make sense, though, from a move standpoint. I mean, there was no one else to go down, and I think it's just a pure performance, you know, reaction. It's, you know, the bullpen's been really great. We're coming up on a scenario where you're actually going to have to maybe send someone down that doesn't deserve to be sent down at all. Once you start getting all those guys back from the IL, Romano, Richards, potentially Chad Green, maybe a little further down the line now, but eventually. And so, yeah, like, it came down to Alek Manoah was their sixth best starter, and they were going back to a 5-man rotation, and he was just the odd man out. And it, you know, I think that there were still positives when he came back. I think that there was definitely progress that he made. I think there was a few outings where you're like, oh, the slider looks better. There was a few outings where his command was a little better, but I think, like, overall, it still was, you know, not quite what he was able to do last year for sure. And when you kind of examined his performance against everybody else that was pitching in the rotation, like, you know, his was just the sixth best, you know, like, that's just how it came down. And I think that you like what Ryu's doing for you. I think you like his different look. I think the fact that he's left-handed is probably an advantage for him too. It helps you with matchups down the road and all the teams the Blue Jays will be facing. And so I think it came down to that. And you have to consider, you know, Manoah, the biggest thing with him this year has been a lack of pitch efficiency too. And given the work of the bullpen, you want to keep them as fresh as possible. So if you can avoid, you know, having him leave games after 4 innings or 5 innings, that's only going to be better too.
I agree with you, Caitlin. I thought the entire time that the meritocratous decision would be Alek Manoah goes down to the minors again and continues to work on things. I was a little surprised that they did it, just given how much we've heard about, well, Alek Manoah's confidence and you want to build it up and be careful and things. And yeah, I guess after the Boston start, I kind of thought, okay, well, maybe he's turned a corner here, even though the results weren't, you know, everything wasn't unbelievable, but it looked a little bit more like Alek Manoah, but it went the other way. And I think this also tells us something about their confidence level in Hyunjin Ryu. Caitlin, acknowledging once again that obviously injuries happen, plans change September, you could expand the roster, although I'd imagine they'd prefer the extra bullpen arm to a sixth starter then. What is next for Alek Manoah in terms of, you know, maybe the team hasn't said, hey, A, B, and C is what he's working on, but for us, evaluating him, trying to determine what the next part of his story is, are your eyes kind of on 2024 at this point now?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some scenario where he makes an impact, but that scenario was probably someone else getting injured. Like you said, you could bring him back when the rosters expand, but I think just looking at the timing of everything, like, that could also be the time when you're adding Chad Green, and I think you'd rather the bullpen arm, or if you added Chad Green before then, and you, say, have optioned, you know, Yenesis Cabrera or Jay Jackson, you want to bring them back up. So I think that it's just a matter of, you know, for Manoah, they really just see him as a starter, and I don't know that they're super keen on moving him to the bullpen anyway, and I don't know that, you know, the way that he's been pitching this year, I'm not sure that you're confident having him come out of the bullpen, just because there has been sort of a lack of consistent strike throwing. You don't want to put your bullpen in that position. So I do think realistically, in terms of making a big impact, you're probably looking at 2024. I mean, you know, maybe there's a scenario where there is somewhat of a storybook ending and he does come back because, you know, someone gets injured and he's really impactful in those last couple of starts. That could happen. But, you know, that feels more like Hollywood script than what we're dealing with right now. But you never know. Ryu is kind of living out of Hollywood script right now. So it happens. But I do think that, yeah, the way that he pitched this year, and I think he deserves credit for, you know, handling the demotions and being a real professional about it and trying to work throughout the season, but it's tough to make those adjustments in season, and he did a good job. I think he did look better when he came back, just not quite consistent enough, and I think that an off season of, you know, work and coming into spring really ready to go next season is probably the main focus now.
Yeah, I think it pretty much has to be. And yeah, like you said, there are scenarios where they need him again, spot start, six-man rotation for a bit in September with larger rosters, whatever. He has to obviously stay ready. But I think, you know, I don't know that it'll be the worst thing for him to just go down there and know he's starting every fifth day or every fifth game and just be able to focus on that stuff well. Because I'd imagine, as much as he's a competitor and loves being around the team and they supported him and stuff, the knowing you're hurting your team in the middle of a playoff race is probably not the nicest thing to manage mentally while you're trying to figure out all your mechanics and things like that. So Caitlin, the Jays had an off day yesterday. They have an off day Thursday. They have another off day Monday. The easy part of this is, while the rotation is five guys now and there are five games over this 8-day stretch, that part's straightforward. I know you wrote about this at the Athletic coming out of the 17 game and 17 day stretch, beyond just the value to resetting the rotation and figuring that out, how crucial is this week plus for a Jays team that has obviously been fortunate injury wise, but is pretty banged up lately?
Yeah, I think it's big. I like that Thursday off day. Like, it works really well for their kind of schedule. Like, it feels like Romano's going to come back today after the off day. So they'll have him for this Philly series. And then there's a couple guys that I think are technically eligible to come off the IL on Thursday, which is an off day for them. So you can activate them on Friday and have them available for that Cincinnati series. I think Trevor Richards probably very likely to come back once he's eligible. And I think Kevin Kiermaier as well is in line to not need any more time. I guess the big one is Bo. His is more fluid. You want to be sort of extra careful with him. Just the knee and any sort of, you know, sharp movement or aggressive movement with the knee, something could go wrong. So you really want to be careful with him. And that's the one you're more trying to really game plan when the best part to activate him would be. So is it after the Thursday off day, or is it not using him in Cincinnati, taking advantage of one more off day next Monday, but having him available for that Baltimore series, which probably is the bigger series of the two, even though obviously you want to win both series and win as many games as you can right now. But I do think this week is really big for the Blue Jays because, you know, you're only having a two-game series to go and not having, you know, two of your guys back, Richards and Kiermaier. And then, yeah, you could look down the road and two bigger three-game series coming up where you could get guys back as well. So as much as it was tough to go through the 17 with as many injuries as they've had, I think now they're in an opportune spot to kind of maximize bringing guys off the IL, getting them maybe that one extra day to rest, and then, you know, using them in series where they really matter.
When it comes to the starting rotation now, obviously everyone's going to pitch on a little bit better rest and on a more standard rotation. We have heard Chris Bassitt and on the Philadelphia Phillies side as they move to a six-man rotation here, Zach Wheeler as well. Talk about, I kind of don't like it. Kind of would rather be on routine. Zach Wheeler even told your colleague Matt Gelb at The Athletic that he'd rather be at 80% after 4 days off than maybe 90% with the extra day off, just from a routine standpoint. Obviously long-term, that's the view we're taking here. You have to keep your guys as well-rested as possible. Is that something the Jays need to be aware of here and manage carefully, or is that too ancillary a consideration?
Yeah, I don't know. I've never really explored that with some of the Blue Jays starters. And you look at the numbers and, like, the some guys do pitch better on rest. And I think it probably matters about context and what's happening. Like, you know, obviously when the Blue Jays were down to, like, a four-man rotation, like, they were grateful for that extra rest and they could get it. And I think, you know, coming out of that, the guys were pretty gassed. They talked about that. And so having the six-man rotation, I think, was a good opportunity, and for the most part it worked. You know, the guys pitched really well. I mean, that Cleveland series was incredible from a pitching standpoint, and so I think you feel satisfied that you used it in a smart, strategic way. But I think that, you know, they've had that extra rest now. You can maximize these off days now, and then when you really get down to the stretch, you know, I would assume that guys at that point of the year, yeah, they're hurting, but they're probably running on a certain level of adrenaline. They're always running on adrenaline, obviously, like they're major league athletes. But I would say, like, you know, games mattering more, things are on the line. I think you'd want to be out there. I think you'd be operating on some adrenaline. I think that you'd want your routine to be pretty consistent at that point. And from a team point of view, like, you want your best guys out there most often. Like, when it comes down to it, like, you know, going back to Manoah, it's like, you know, why use Manoah for a start when you're not sure that he's going to put your position in the best place to win, you know, unfortunately, because he's pitching, throwing too many pitches or whatever it may be, where, you know, you could have had a Kikuchi making that start and you're feeling pretty good about the way Kikuchi's pitching right now. So I think it's more from a team strategy standpoint. Like, you got to just get as many wins as you can with your best guys right now. And your best guys are used to going every fifth day. And so if they can do that right now, you got to do that. And, you know, the other advantage with Ryu coming back is he's probably pretty fresh, right? Like, mm-hmm. He's three starts, he's amped to go, you know, and the other guys, you've got a really durable rotation that are kind of proven guys that have pitched a ton of innings year in and year out. So you feel pretty good where you're at right now, I think.
Caitlin, with respect to that adrenaline element, I guess there's also the element of everyone other than Gausman and Berríos are probably competing for, hey, what if there's a game three in a wild card series, or what if you get to a seven game series, who is going to start that? Do you get the sense that, I mean, it's early for this talk, I guess we still got 6 weeks left, but that outside of Gausman, Berríos, who would line up in playoff games is still pretty open?
Oh, I think so. And I think it would really depend on matchups. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, because you're looking at, obviously, the decision would probably be with respect to Hyunjin Ryu, like Chris Bassitt or Yusei Kikuchi. And those are two really different types of pitchers, right? So if a team can't hit lefties, I think you're going to go with Kikuchi. If a team tends to be kind of really bad against finesse guys that can throw a lot of different things, obviously your decision is pretty easy and you go with Bassitt. Like, you know, there's probably other considerations. There's intangible considerations that I think the Blue Jays would probably consider too. They are very like methodic and analytical, of course. So I think the numbers would have a big say in it. But there would be intangible too. You know, Yusei Kikuchi, no experience in the postseason, I don't think. And whereas Bassett, he has made some pretty big starts. He's made some good starts with Oakland and in those wild card days. I know a start with the Mets didn't go so well last year, but he's at least been in that spot before. And I remember when the Blue Jays signed him, I think one of the reasons, you know, at the time, Ross Atkins was talking about him and listening, like, why they signed him. And one of the things was for his playoff experience. And so I do think that it would be probably a pretty lengthy discussion. Now things could change. You know, one of those two pitchers could have, you know, a tough September and make the decision easier. But like all things being equal, them, let's say, just kind of pitching the same way they've been pitching all season long, or at least in the second half. Yeah, I think it's a lengthy discussion, and I think you could have split decision on it. I think that it would really depend on matchups. It would really depend on who they're facing, maybe even where they are in the series. Well, I guess at that point they'd be tied. But like, I think that maybe there's a way that you could get creative too and piggyback them as well, you know, all hands on deck. I'm not sure. But I do think it'd be an interesting discussion, and, you know, hopefully we get to have it.
Yeah, I hope so. That would be, and hopefully we get to have more of the, hey, who starts game four conversation than who starts game three of a wild card. That is, that's not the way any of us want this season to end like last year. So on the hitting side, obviously, look, we're talking about good problems on the pitching side. We're talking about a bullpen that's been one of the very best in baseball, and someone having to come out of that bullpen, probably Nate Pearson today when Jordan Romano returns, and then someone else when Trevor Richards returns. We're talking about a rotation that has five guys who have mostly pitched pretty well so far. You'd wonder then, why isn't this team like at the top of the table? Why aren't they in the division mix? Why are we talking about wild card? And it is, of course, because with the exception of the last two Sundays, this team hasn't really hit particularly well. Caitlin, I know in your latest mailbag at The Athletic, you got asked kind of, hey, do we need to reset our levels on Vlad and what our expectations are for Vladimir Guerrero Jr.? And we can get into, you know, some of the underlying stuff. Yes, it is in the Statcast era, so almost a decade now, it's like a top 10 season for your actual results underperforming your expected results. That's true, but also he's swinging more. He's doing damage on stuff over the heart of the plate less. He's certainly, you know, watching him, and as much as we can read the mechanics when Joe Siddle and Caleb Joseph point them out for us, it looks like there are some things that are not in alignment there and maybe some pressing there. Where are you in terms of your expectations for Vladimir Guerrero Jr. the rest of the way, and kind of resetting our expectation level now that, you know, we've got another season of him being a roughly 800 OPS guy versus a 1000 OPS guy?
Yeah, I mean, I think the one thing that I come back to a lot of the times is the age. And I know that, you know, on the one hand, maybe people don't want to listen to that or accept that, but he is still really young. I mean, a lot of guys aren't even making their debuts until they're 23, 24 years old. He's been in the majors for 5 years at this point. So on the one hand, you're hoping that he's adjusted. But on the other hand, like, you know, his path is unique. Like, he was a really gifted minor league player, a player that, you know, probably didn't have to, I don't want to say he didn't have to work hard, but I mean, he was able to use his talent in such a way that he was just dominant in the minor leagues. And I think that the majors has been, you know, a different experience for him. It's a lot of adjustments, and, you know, guys will say, like, you really can't get by your talent. Even the most talented, you know, players have to make adjustments all the time. And, you know, I think for Vlad, it's still been a learning experience. I think with him too, like, you know, I get the sense that he does care a lot. That's never been an issue. And I almost think that sometimes he can care too much, in the sense that, you know, he really wants to come up in those big moments, and he probably does put a lot of pressure on himself. I think there's probably some truth to the difference in numbers on the road and at home, honestly. Like, you know, that's just anecdotal for me and sort of me speculating. But, you know, I could see that being possible. And so I think that there's still encouraging things. You talked about all the raw numbers. You talked about just the expected results being better than the actual results. And so I think you can take some some good from that. And I think that it's really down to pitch selection for him. And, you know he can do it. He's had that season. I know 2021 feels a long time ago. And there was other things. Maybe there's a different ball and all these different factors. But, yeah, I think that, you know, I'm not down on Vlad. And I understand fans can be fickle. But I think keep the faith and he'll probably reward us.
You certainly have to hope so. And obviously there are some indicators that say it's coming soon. Some indicators that say just, you know, hey, be a little patient longer term. We're also going to see a guy this series in Bryce Harper, who had some of the similar things, came up at 19, was awesome out of the gate, took a little bit to find his level from just good to truly great. Now, right now he's back to kind of just good, but that is mostly injury related. So he's an interesting example to look at year by year. Caitlin, before I let you go, last one for you. Whether today, whether Friday, you know, let's be reasonably optimistic and say Friday, Bobuchek comes off the IL, he's ready to go. Who is going down? Davis Schneider obviously has options. He was very hot against the Boston Red Sox. He's cooled off since, even though you still like the approach. I think Santiago Espinal offers some defensive versatility and has hit the last couple games. Kevin Biggio is, I think, a little more insulated from that decision. Do you have a lean as to who you think the odd bench player out would be when Bobuchet returns?
It's probably Davis Schneider, just because a little bit last man in, first man out situation. I think he does have options. He has cooled off since Boston, although he's still giving you good at bats and stuff. And I think the message is pretty clear to him. It's like, we'll see you in 2 weeks or whatever it is. Or, you know what I mean? Like, I don't think it's going to be devastating. I think it'll be like, you know what, thank you, and you'll be back here very soon. Go down in Buffalo, keep doing what you're doing, and you're going to have an impact on us in September. And I think that is just the easiest decision. I think the other situation, like, you could disrupt the flow of the team a little bit. Espinal, you know, at the same, if Schneider was still, like, you know, having four hits a night, then the decision is so different. But Espinal's been doing well lately. You know, manager John Schneider has been making a point lately of pointing out his at bat and his work. So to me, I think it's fairly easy decision, Davis Schneider. And he'll be back before you know it, basically.
Yeah, the September 1st is coming up pretty quickly here. So go down, get a week's worth of plate appearances in, and then you'll be right back up there. Plus, you can pal around with Alek Manoah, catch up with him a little bit. Caitlin McGrath, great to catch up with you. I will see you down at the park a little later.
Sounds good. See you.
Caitlin McGrath of The Athletic. Make sure you're checking out all her great work there. Had some great insight on the Manoah decision at longer length over there, right up on the Jose Bautista weekend, of course. And then, yeah, some of the comments internally about how nice it is to have these three off days over an 8-day stretch, even if it does make for tougher radio weeks to structure with so many off days. Caitlin also had a mailbag there. I didn't pull too many questions from that, but if you had more questions for Caitlin, I'm sure she probably answered them within there. A couple of them even came up yesterday in our mailbag segment about the futures of, say, a Whit Merrifield or a Matt Chapman, pieces like that. Also down at the ballpark this week. Yeah, it's Looney Dog night tonight. You know how I feel about that. But tomorrow is one of the coolest nights of the year. It's the Jays Care broadcast auction presented by TD. So Ivanka Osmak will be hosting that throughout the broadcast, and the television broadcast will be checking in with what's going on there. If you missed prior years, there are so many cool things you can bid on. There are also buy now options for a lot of the different prizes there. This fundraiser has raised over $2 million to support Jays Care programming for children and youth across Canada over the 15 years it's existed. This is year 16. So we'll see if we can push that number higher. There are a number of things you can bid on. Obviously, I'm not going to read them all off here, but you can check out the Jays Care website and Twitter pages for more details. We'll try to highlight a couple of them as we go through the next 2 days. The one that sticks out to me, just looking at it here quickly, first is that there's a Sportsnet experience with Donovan Bennett. I wasn't asked to be a part of that. Maybe that's, again, like with the 50-50 draw, if you come last place, I'm the person who calls you. But there is a golf trip, or the chance to do a round of golf, rather, with Joe Carter, obviously a Blue Jays legend, and Adam Hadwin. That's a pretty cool one. There's also a golf round with Russell Martin, which is pretty interesting. If you are a golf person, there is a date night at Rogers Center. I don't know exactly what that entails, but for those of you looking for love at the ballpark out there, like our Gate 14 pals, maybe. And then there's a bunch of other great stuff. Boba Shett hand-painted jersey, a couple of hand-painted items by artist David Arrigo, lots of stuff like that. So keep an eye out for more details there. Keep an ear out on the broadcast, radio and television. Tonight, we'll have more details for you there, and we'll continue to highlight some of those items throughout today and tomorrow's show. You can check out the Jays Care Foundation website and Twitter for more. We're going to take a break. We're going to go back down to Buffalo. Kind of. MLB Pipeline has their updated top 30s for each franchise right now in terms of prospect rankings. Couple of AAA Buffalo Bisons ranking pretty high there for the Blue Jays, including Aurelvis Martinez, who is just inside MLB Pipeline's latest top 100, coming in at number 93. Ricky Tiedemann also at 33. Jonathan Mayo of MLB Pipeline will join us next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Discussing the biggest stories that matter to Toronto sports fans. The Fan Morning Show with Ailish Forfar and Justin Cuthbert. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Toronto Blue Jays don't have the best system in baseball, but they've got a pretty interesting one. And it's always a lot of fun to compare the different sites, but one of, I think, probably my favorite to look at for top prospect rankings, because they're also integrated into some of the minor league box scores that I check day to day, is MLB Pipeline. There's this cool thing where there's a page of where you can see the box score from every team's affiliate every single day. And the thing that MLB does is if someone ranks in their MLB Pipeline's top 30, they're highlighted in there. So you can find the prospects you're spicy for nice and quick. Now that's true of all teams, but it's useful if you're a Jays fan. If you don't know where to find that, by the way, message me later and I will send you the link, because it's a little hidden on the MLB sites, but yes, very, very useful tool. And if you had been looking over the last couple of days, you might notice that different names are highlighted now, because MLB Pipeline has updated their top 30 by team, as well as their top 100 here now that we're post-draft, post-trade deadline, and things like that. Jonathan Mayo of MLB Pipeline joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Blake. How are you?
I'm doing well. Before we get into some of the MLB Pipeline stuff, Jonathan, you're also the author of Smart, Wrong, and Lucky, The Origin Stories of Baseball's Unexpected Stars. I'm curious how, going through the process of writing that book, and obviously we all know as baseball fans that guys kind of come out of nowhere sometimes, there are always surprises, but you went so deep on the guys who weren't supposed to make it and the unexpected ways they made it to the majors. The exercise of doing that and going deeper on those stories and writing that book, how much has that changed how you approach things like prospect rankings and prospect write-ups now for guys that, you know, hey, you don't know if the guys that aren't ranked are going to turn into one of those, but I'm curious how those things have kind of played into each other.
Yeah, I don't think it changed too much how we look at, you know, how I look at the rankings, knowing that that's a very imperfect and inexact science. There are always going to be guys that aren't ranked high enough or not ranked at all who end up, you know, turning into solid big leaguers to stars. And, you know, in doing the rankings and in all I do, I talk to scouts all the time. And that's kind of where these stories emanated from, because they're great storytellers and they all have tremendous tales to spin about. They like talking about guys they missed on. Oh, I should have taken this guy. But they also, you know, either about themselves or more likely about one of their colleagues. Like, oh, but you need to talk to this scout because he's the guy that, you know, knew that you should, you know, that there was something in Jacob DeGrom in the, you know, in the 8th or 9th round, or Albert Pujols in the 13th round, or, you know, for fans in Canada, you know, Joey Votto is in the book and he was a second rounder, but that was a bit of a surprise to a lot of people in the industry at the time.
Is there, in going through this exercise and looking at some of those success stories, is there any sort of common thread of, hey, this is the thing we've tended to overlook or underrate over the years? Or is it really just kind of a case-by-case basis? And I bring this up just because the Blue Jays have one of these right now in Davis Schneider debuting and making a hot little run here. And I wonder if, you know, he checks some of the boxes that you kept coming across in writing the book.
Well, I think there are a couple of things that stand out. And, you know, one thing is that this book really looks at the sort of front end of how they were scouted and evaluated and ultimately selected and signed, and not as much about what happens on the player development side. So I think that in terms of a threat on the front end, the one thing in terms, with the pitchers is that, I think too much attention is spent looking at radar guns, and scouts will even admit this, but you can't not, and that a couple things can happen. Guys can throw harder. I mean, that's what happened with Jacob DeGrom. That's what happened with Shane Bieber. The pitchers I highlight in the book, both of whom were kind of known for their command and their ability to spin the ball a little bit in terms of Jacob DeGrom, who was mostly a shortstop in college, really didn't pitch full time at all until his junior year. And even then he was still playing shortstop. So that's the one thing on that end. And then on the other end, I mean, a lot of these guys end up having, some chips on their shoulders. And I honestly don't know Davis Schneider, but I'm going to guess, as a sort of undersized guy who was a 28th round pick, they all feel that they have something to prove. And some of them, felt like that they were much better players than where they were drafted, represented. And they used that to fuel them to become the big leaders they become. Thinking about a guy like Ian Kinsler, who, bounced around different organizations. Bounced around different colleges, played at three different schools, lost a starting spot at Arizona State to Dustin Pedroia, had a transfer to Missouri, wasn't known there, got hurt. So he ended up going in, round 17, but knew he was going to be a big leaguer and always played with that kind of chip. Albert Pujols told me that he always had this desire to show people that he should not have been overlooked the way he was. He was a 13th rounder. Out of a small junior college, in the Midwest. So I think that's maybe the thread that carried them once they signed and helped motivate and fuel them to become who they became.
And that book is, again, Smart, Wrong, and Lucky, The Origin Stories of Baseball's Unexpected Stars. And on the other end of this is the guys we know are prospects and are scouted highly and ranked highly and things like that. So at MLB Pipeline, you guys have recently updated the top 100, the top 30 for each organization. I want to start on the Blue Jays, of course. Ricky Tiedemann coming in at number 33. Now, he's had a bit of a stop-start year here. Obviously, the stuff is the stuff. It's pretty electric. Even when he's made short rehab appearances the last little while, the strikeout numbers are pretty remarkable. How difficult is it ranking a guy who, first of all, is still very young, just about to turn 21 this week, but is, mostly stuff at this point and not a lot of actual in-game track record because of injuries and caution with the workload?
Yeah, I think that injuries to pitchers are the hardest thing, and it's a weird thing because we've gotten to the point now, if a guy has Tommy John surgery, we don't go too nuts in knocking him down because they tend to come back pretty strong from that. Now, we don't know. We still are trying to figure out what happens if you have Tommy John surgery when you're super young and whether or not, the elbow breaks down again later on. But I think with a guy like Tiedemann, he showed such incredible stuff last year. And he was only 70, not quite 79 innings, but with some feel, right? This wasn't a guy who was walking nine guys per nine, right? This year has been tougher because he's missed so much time. It was an interesting sort of debate between him and Kyle Harrison, the lefty from the Giants, in terms of who's the best left-handed pitching prospect in the game right now. Harrison's had command issues, had a little bit of a hamstring issue as well, but nothing arm-related. So he got the slight edge above Tiedemann. We're still very, very high in Ricky Tiedemann. That's why we had him as high as he did. And you mentioned how young he is. It's not time to worry yet. And you're going to err on the side of caution from a player development standpoint when a pitcher that talented and that young has some nicks and bruises, so to speak, along the way. But I think next year, I don't want to say a guy's 21, it's like a big year for him. I think getting him to, say, 100 innings, even if he spends all year in the minors, it will be a good step forward. And honestly, if he stays healthy next year, I think you're going to see him in Toronto at some point.
That was on the table this year of, hey, if he stays healthy and he's good, maybe he could get some late season innings with Toronto. Obviously, that hasn't happened. Another 21-year-old who has ascended through the minors, I mean, not fast because he's been in the system so long, but he has reached 21, right, reached AAA now at age 21, is Aurelvis Martinez. He was repeating AA to start this year. Tough start to the year, but a big step forward by the time he earned the promotion. And not going all world or anything like that in his start at AAA, but a pretty solid first 20 or so games there. Aurelvis Martinez sneaks into the top 100 at number 93. What have you liked about his 2023 season?
Well, I think, you know, the power is obviously legitimate, and I think he's shown that over, you know, the last couple of years. And then the question is, well, what about the approach? The strikeouts have been more in check this year. He's drawing more walks. And I think it's the combination of those two things has allowed him to get to the power again and not give away at bats as much. He's a little bit of a divisive player in terms of, you know, when we're ranking him, and we'll do our top 100 and then we'll send it out to as many scouting directors and executives as we can. And we get a bunch of feedback. And he was one of those guys that we had, one or two people say, no, he shouldn't even be on the top 100. And one or two people saying, you're too low, move him way up. It depends on when you see him. That power is going to play, and I think regardless of what position he's going to be, I think he's going to have the chance to be a like power / run producing infielder of some sort. There are some question marks, just in terms of the overall hit tool. That's, like I said, I think that's gotten a lot better. I think he probably ends up at third, where the power is more important. And I think he's going to have that profile. And then added to the mix, as you mentioned, he is still very, very young and playing at a high level. It seems like we've been talking about him forever. But as you pointed out, he's in AAA now, and he's played this entire season at age 21. So in a lot of ways, he's way ahead of the curve. And we have to be mindful of that when we start getting a little prospect fatigue with guys who have been around for quite some time.
Which is a good warning if anyone is, 3, 4, or 5 years from now impatient with Arjun Amala, who is entering ball at only 17, has played a handful of complex league games now. He was obviously the Jays' first round pick, number 20 overall. He slots in as the Jays' number 3 prospect. Now, this question can be about Amala, or it can be about, Skeens and Cruz coming in number 3 and number 4 in the overall top 100. But just generally, where is the challenge in slotting recent draftees in to a top 100 or an internal an organization ranking list with guys who at least have a bit of minor league track record at this point? What sort of things are you weighing against each other when you decide where to slot recent draft picks in?
It is quite difficult, and Skeens and Cruz, that's the highest we've ever had any duo from the recent draft, but that I think reflects how special the top of this draft class and all 5 of those top 5 guys, Wyatt Langford and Max Clark and Walker Jenkins, are all in our top 20. And that's never happened before either. And those 5 really had separated themselves, and all 5 of those guys could have been number 1 picks in any draft. So we wanted to be kind of aggressive with them. One of the things that's, difficult is that you're not talking to the same people when you're ranking the list, because when we're doing our draft ranking, we're talking to amateur scouts and amateur scouting directors. And on the pro side, we're talking to pro scouting directors. And for a top 30 list, we will look both internally and externally. And one of the issues you have is when you're trying to figure out where to put Arjun Amala on the Blue Jays list, the Blue Jays player development system people haven't really seen him. Or haven't seen much of him. Maybe they're getting a very, very early look. So we try to find a bridge. Maybe we'll try to find people within the organization who have a feel on both sides of that ledger, which isn't always easy. So it's a little guesswork, and you'll see some some adjustments made so that, you know, if Arjun goes out and, you know, plays well the rest of this year and looks really good in struts, you may see him, you know, bump ahead of Aurelvis Martinez, or even maybe, I wouldn't say he's not going to leap over Ricky Tiedemann before he starts playing, but that will then sort of, we'll start looking at as he hits full season ball, presumably at the beginning of next year at age 18, how he handles that challenge. And I'm a big Arjun Namala fan, so I actually think he is going to move up the list and jump onto our top 100 once he gets going, you know, in earnest.
Well, that's exciting. The bat speed and the high finish, Mookie Betts like finish. Obviously, we haven't seen a ton of clips of it from the Complex League yet, but they're the right buzz terms that the Blue Jays sprinkle in there for us. Last Jay specific one for you, Jonathan, about a name who has risen up in the system rankings a little bit this year. I don't know that he's a name everyone was super familiar with coming into this season. Alan Roden, a third round pick last year, a little bit overage. So, you know, he hits a ball last year at 22. Maybe we expect him to hit the ground running a little bit. He's already up to double A now. And he's up to, I think you guys have him as the number 7 prospect in the Blue Jays system. That has happened pretty quickly. And I understand that a guy being a little older, we've got to be a little careful with the immediate success, but what do you like about Alan Roden and what should we keeping an eye on as he moves up through the system here?
Yeah, I think that, you know, he came in as a guy who had been known for making contact, and then you just want to see how it's going to play. And what he did in Vancouver was kind of hard to ignore. And so he went from, speaking of, you know, a slightly later round, not super late round, draft guy, who is a little tiny bit older. But the fact that he did what you would expect him to do, and then some, and then earn the promotion up to double A, where he's no longer really like old for his level and has continued to do the same kinds of things. Obviously the main stats that people may look at don't jump off the page, but he's still drawing a ton of walks. He's getting on base. He's shown that he can, that he's a solid outfielder when he was more kind of seemed like a first base type. And then, so an under 6 foot first baseman without a ton of power is a really tough profile. but a guy who can play both outfield corners, maybe help out at first base, can steal a base. You know, he does a lot of little things really, really well. I think he has a chance to be an everyday guy, even if he moves around, just because of the hit and the on-base ability and just enough sneaky pop to keep pitchers honest.
Yeah, it's not bad. 6 home runs this year through 89 games. I guess, Jonathan, this is the last one before I let you go here. And this is, again, not Jay specific, but as we look around minor league baseball and we see different rules being applied at different levels. You know, we've got the ABS system, sometimes a AAA, the challenge system, sometimes there. Obviously, different leagues have different hit environments. Is walk rate kind of the toughest thing to extrapolate when you're just scouting the stat line?
Well, I mean, I think knowledge of the strike zone is still knowledge of the strike zone, regardless of whether it's a human calling balls and strikes or a machine or a robot or whatever, however you want to call it. So, the ability to make, decisions. So I guess it may come down to less of a walk rate, which is the sort of way to quantify it, and more swing decisions. Which there are advanced metrics for that kind of thing, but it's not as like easy to look at a stat line and be like, oh, he's making really good swing decisions, because just because a guy's drawing walks doesn't mean that he's swinging at, pitches he should be swinging at and doing damage with them. So I think it's, a combination of the ability to work counts and also hit the ball hard when you should, right? So if you see a 2-0 fastball and don't right down the middle of the plate and don't swing at it, that's not great, even if it means your walk rate is high. So, I think it's kind of a combination of all the different things that people talk about, exit velocities, hard hit rates, what you do with different pitches, along with the ability to draw walks.
good reminder that we can only see so much from the stat line, and that's where tools like MLB Pipeline come in so valuable. Jonathan Mayo, thanks so much for taking the time out this morning, man.
Thanks for having me.
Jonathan Mayo, MLB Pipeline. You can go check out the rest of the Blue Jays internal top 30, as well as his book, Smart, Wrong, and Lucky, The Origin Stories of Baseball's Unexpected Stars. Brandon Barriera still coming in at fourth on the Blue Jays internal rankings. I do wonder if that changes at some point, just given he's been shut down again and they've been pretty shush about it. The other interesting name we ran out of time to ask Jonathan about is Emmanuel Bonilla. He was the Blue Jays' top international signing in the last period. He's ranked as the number 7 international prospect, which is a separate ranking from the top 100. It is just the Dominican Summer League, but as a 17-year-old, he is absolutely killing it down there, hitting just shy of 300 with an OPS just a little north of 800. Not a lot of power in the profile yet, but for a 17-year-old to have a 13% walk rate, not strike out a ton, and you know, put the speed into action a little bit for batting average on balls in play, handful of steals. It's an exciting stat line, and he's really trended in the right direction. If you're someone like me who looks at the box scores more or less daily, he's had a couple of monster performances in July and August to push that line forward. So another name to keep in mind. We're going to take a break, switch it back from prospecting to the current team. Chris Black joins us for his regular Tuesday spot next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Diving deep into Leafs, Raptors, Jays, and NFL. The JD Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. It's Tuesday and tennis is done. So we get Chris Black. He's at Down to Black on Twitter. I can't see yet if his Hyunjin Ryu thread has come out, but there's one coming today or at some point before Hyunjin Ryu's next start. Fresh off the National Bank Open, Chris Black at Down to Black, producer at Sportsnet. How are you, buddy?
The thread has not dropped yet. I'm still moving a little slowly post tennis. Still,
what? They were only like 18-hour days. What's the big deal?
There was, I think it was the Friday, the days blend together. The math on the 5 matches on center court that day, over 1,000 points played on center court that day. 15 hours, we were up at noon. We signed off at 3 a.m. Still recovering. That one's going to go in the book at the end of my career.
Wow. Who would have guessed the what is higher, points on that court that day or Vlad's OPS right now? Who would have thought it was tennis in a landslide? Ooh. Okay, so there, the Hyunjin Ryu thread is coming at some point. Ryu's not starting tonight or tomorrow, but I know it's a thread you're excited about. You think you picked up something in his last start, enough so that you're bugging Petriello about it and getting him to dig in on Baseball Savant. What did you see in Hyunjin Ryu's last start that caught your eye?
Well, first of all, I don't need much of a reason to bug Mike Petriello with stuff. Sometimes it's just if I haven't spoken to him in a while, I just want to reach out and bug him a bit. And he's such a good sport that he puts up with me all the time. But yeah, Ryu was interesting because I didn't see his start live, obviously, on Sunday. That's when the final was in Montreal. But I watched it yesterday morning. And to be honest, what stood out was the absolute first played appearance of the game. I watched. It was, I don't remember who he faced, to be honest, but fastball down and away, change up down, fastball down and in, change up out and away. And if you just watched how he got him out, the change up down and away, you'd say, you know, we've all seen that story from Hyunjin Ryu a million times before, but the sequence, all four pitches down in the zone, and especially that first pitch down and away, like it just looked, it looked different than a lot of the pitches we've seen from Hyunjin Ryu over the last few years. So dove in a little bit more, and it moved a little bit different than most of his fastballs. So that's when I bugged Petriello and talked to some people, and he talked to some people who are way smarter than me. He's just smarter than me, but there's other people who are way, way smarter. And yeah, they said, yeah, it kind of moves. He's had a few this year that are more like sinkers than four-seamers. So that was kind of the first kind of thing that stood out.
Look, the sinker is a pitch that Hyunjin Ryu has thrown in the past. You go back to his early Dodgers days, and it was his number two pitch at times after his four-seam fastball, and he'd kind of slowly gotten away from it, used the cutter for a little bit, emphasized the changeup a little bit more. I still think fastball changeup is going to be his bread and butter, and we'll see where the exact percentage comes down once Baseball Savant splits these up from fastball to sinker. But what do you like about that addition, other than just, you know, hey, Ryu as a finesse and sequencing and artiste kind of guy, having a fifth pitch is better than only having four. What do you like about what the sinker allows him to do specifically?
I think it's kind of in response to them going away from the cutter. I think a few years ago, the cutter was a really good weapon for Ryu. And I think now where it's at, sitting at 84, 85, I don't know that he can get into righties with that cutter the way he could.
It's just kind of a bad slider at this point, right?
A little bit. Yeah. So I think because that's gone away as a weapon, they had to kind of get in the lab and figure out, you know, what are some other ways you can get righties out. And the thing that stands out is he's working away from righties, obviously super small samples, but working away from righties more than he ever has with the Jays. Like, you have to go back to Dodgers days when he was working away this much. And that ties back to what you were talking about when he was throwing sinkers. And the other thing that stands out, he's working down in the zone more than he ever has. So I think it's in response to the cutter. And also they think these sinkers away can kind of tunnel with the changeups out of the zone away pretty good. That's one possible theory. And we've seen the changeup. He really hasn't been forced to bring it into the zone yet. It seems like teams have kind of forgotten what Ryu throws, or maybe it's just tunneling really well off of these fastballs away. So it might just be the changeup, not having to bring the changeup into the zone might be a kind of a check mark of, yeah, this is tunneling well off of this sinker.
And we've also, you know, the thing we hear about Hyunjin Ryu in his return, but also over the years, is he's a guy that if he misses where he wants to miss. And it's a lot safer to miss low than to miss to other spots that you can miss to. So having another option to work low in the zone, you know, he's a guy too, who when he's been at his very best, had some pretty good ground ball rates. So if he can get back to that as well, maybe that helps you account for what we anticipate will continue as a drop off in strikeout rate, because the swing and miss stuff probably isn't coming back to, you know, 2020 or 2014 levels. So that'll be something to watch when Hyunjin Ryu starts again. The Jays are going with Kikuchi and Gausman for this two-game set against the Phillies. Chris, I talked about it a little bit with Caitlin, but because you and I haven't gotten to talk about it yet, what is your thought on the Alek Manoah being sent to AAA decision now that the Jays only need five starters here? And is there much you're going to be taking from those AAA results, given, you know, how all over the place the last time ramping back up was?
Yeah, well, to be honest, like, no, I guess to answer that last question first, no, like, I'm not going to take a lot away. That's like the Manoah story to me, and that, like, my takeaway from that choice they made, it's more about Yusei Kikuchi. Mm-hmm. It's a Yusei Kikuchi story more than it is an Alek Manoah story. If Kikuchi was still a five-inning, three-earned run guy, which he was at times earlier on this season, I think he'd be in the bullpen, and Manoah would be on the major league roster working through his own stuff. But I think Kikuchi's kind of awesome performances have kind of earned this call. Like, there's always stuff you need to worry about when it comes to Kikuchi. We know the home runs in the past. We know the command he can at times lose the command, but the biggest thing that stands out last couple starts are the ground balls. Like, he's had April through July ground ball rate, like, it's below, or yeah, like, he doesn't get the ball on the ground a ton, kind of ground ball rate upper 30s. But the last two starts, 12 ground balls in each of the last two starts. First time he's had back-to-back games with double-digit grounders since, like, 2021. So, you, like, being that kind of powerful, pounding the zone, that kind of pitcher, but while also getting the ball on the ground, then, yeah, that's a new kind of capability that we haven't seen in the past. So, like I said, like, the Manoah thing, I can see it both ways, and I know a few, like, more than I kind of thought it'd be Kikuchi moving to the pen, but Kikuchi earned and kind of forced them to make that choice.
And the ground ball rate is an important one. Like you said, three of his last four starts, ground ball rate up over 50%, so more than half the batted balls. And then there is a trend also that we're going to talk to Mike Bauman about in a little bit here, that the fly balls he has allowed have been hit hard less frequently. And that is, you know, maybe owing to some pitch mix changes, the curveball being as effective as it has been. But in addition to more ground balls, there's three ways to limit home runs, right? Don't let the ball in play at all, which is striking guys out. There is don't allow the ball in the air, which is ground ball rate. And then there's if you allow the ball in the air, don't allow it to be hit hard. And Kikuchi's kind of checking all three of those boxes right now. Having said that, Chris, there are some underlying indicators that suggest Kikuchi's been a little bit fortunate this year. He doesn't grade out super elite in some of the batted ball metrics. Obviously, the whiff, the walk rate, the strikeout rate, all that stuff is good. But some of the hard contact stuff is still, there are still some minor warning signs. Not major, but enough to keep an eye on it. Do those mean much to you at this point, given what we've seen the last couple starts? Like, I guess I don't think any of us are concerned that Yusei Kikuchi is going to go back to 2022, but do those mean much to you in terms of, hey, maybe we can't pencil him in as quite this good at this point?
I think the Kikuchi is that he's a guy who at times when he misses, he's going to miss over the plate.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not, we just talked about a guy in Ryu who's, I think I've dubbed him the maestro before. Like, his edge rate, he's come back. He hasn't pitched in a year and a half, and he's working the edges more than any other Blue Jay pitcher. Like Ryu is a guy who is not going to miss over the plate. Kikuchi doesn't have that kind of command. Now, it doesn't matter because he's throwing the ball 7 miles an hour harder. He's throwing it with a hard-breaking slider. So he doesn't need to be as fine as Ryu. So he is going to miss over the plate at times. Those balls are going to get hit. But like I said, if he's getting the balls on the ground, if he's, I'm fine with the odd home run. We always have with Kikuchi if they're not three-run home runs, you know what I mean? So it's if he's limiting the traffic on the bases, the odd home run and the odd bit of hard contact, I'm okay with. And, we tend to talk about these things separately, but I always like to kind of remind people, like, this is one of the Jays wanted to improve defense, right? Like, it gives you a benefit and a margin of error when it comes to your pitchers, where some pitchers might start to perform against their batted ball data because you've got Matt Chapman winning a Gold Glove potentially this year, because you've got Gold Glove outfielders. Like, those guys, there's look better even when they're giving up hard contact. So I like him, and he's been outstanding. I wish I could have seen the start live that he threw.
Yeah, he was excellent. And if you are worried about, that kind of meatball percentage is what Baseball Savant calls it, among guys who have thrown enough pitches to qualify, Kikuchi is 21st in how often he throws it right over the heart of the plate out of 117 pitchers who qualify. So it's high, but it's not remarkably high. And the actual outcome on those pitches is not, terribly high either. He's surviving it. And I think, like you said, you're okay with a couple of home runs here and there for Yusei Kikuchi. And especially so now that the walk rate is down, because solo home runs don't hurt you that bad. And he's shown an ability to avoid those big innings that plagued him at times last year. Let's pivot to the hitting side here, Chris. I know last week you had picked up something on Dalton Varsho and a move to a more subtle toe tap, being a little more closed at the plate. So naturally, coming off a week of better results and us identifying that, he comes out and strikes out three times in his next appearance. But he then has, arguably his best game as a Jay on Sunday. If you look at the last 10, his OPS is up to almost 900. Now, we're lowering the bar a little bit here, looking at small samples. But given what you thought you'd identified with Varsho last week, did you see more of what you liked this past week?
A little bit. And I haven't seen as much of, I saw him, like, we have a monitor where all the Sportsnet channels in the truck. And yeah, so when the Jays are on, I watch the Varsho at bats. I peek over when I can take a little bit more of an interest in him over the last year for obvious reasons. But yeah, no, I like it. I like what he's doing. And I like, to be honest, what I like is I feel like he's in the part of the order where he should be. And I understood all the reasons why he started where he did. But I think it might have been a lot for him when you look back at him, when we're all in spring training talking about things next year, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if it all just felt a little bit much for him to come in and be hitting cleanup and all that stuff. Like, he's in the right part of the lineup. And that's, it's also helpful that, like, there's guys at the top who are producing, there's less pressure, and his production is viewed as a bonus rather than necessary. And I always think that that's kind of a good spot for a young new player to be. So I haven't seen a ton of his at-bats, but I feel like this is where he should be right now, and this is where he can kind of, it's easier for him to find success there.
And certainly a case to be made that as things spiraled on him a little bit, given the pressures you're talking about, the pressure he maybe puts on himself, a little bit of an inkling to try to do too much. And I think that's what we saw with George Springer a little bit in his disaster of a July, tying a franchise record for a hitless at-bat streak. Since then, and again, we're lowering bars a little bit here in small samples, but we got to take the samples we're given here. Last 12 games since breaking out of that stretch, George Springer has a .378 batting average, a .976 OPS. Yes, that is a little favorable when it comes to batting average on balls in play on a couple infield singles or ones that squeaked through, but also some extra base hits in there. Home run, four doubles. And Chris, I know that in digging into some of the swing decisions, both by pitch type and location, you think you've identified something that says, hey, George Springer got the message, whether from the coaching staff or from himself, that he was trying to do a little bit too much. And it's actually been simplifying his approach that's helped here.
Yeah, that's what it seems like. As you said, the numbers are a lot better of late. You know, we've heard Caleb this past weekend. I heard him a couple times post games. We've heard Siddle throughout the year mention this. We've heard Buck mention this. Like, you got to hunt the fastball sometimes. And I think that's been driving Springer's success. March through July, .264 average, a slugging around .430, and a run value -4 against fastballs so far in August. Small sample alert, .450 average, .640 slugging around, +3 run value. So he's getting hits. He already has more hits in August against fastballs than he did in July. Now, obviously, July, there weren't a lot of hits against any kind of pitches for Springer, but, you know, when you watch those hits off the fastballs, to me, that's where the story develops, especially when you contrast it against what he did in July. So kind of broke out every month where he's had at least 70 plate appearances. July 2023 was the lowest OPS of those 42. He struggled more last month than he pretty much ever has. July 2023 was also the highest swing rate of those 42. And it seemed to me, not just in those moments, not just during that hitless streak, you know, he was trying to swing his way out of it, which, you know, sometimes like that is the approach you need to do. But also, like, there was like a rational, a valid reason for him to be swinging more. Pitchers have been attacking him more this year than they ever have. He's the highest zone rate since his rookie year, highest zone rate on first pitches, highest zone rates on 1-0 counts. And I think especially when you look at those, the 0-0 and the 1-0 stuff, to me, that the scouting report has challenged this guy, don't fall behind. So if you're seeing that in the box, I think it's reasonable to say, I'm going to be aggressive and I'm going to attack and I'm going to try and swing my way out of this cold stretch. But it didn't work like that. And one of the reasons why is he pulled the ball in the air more often in July 23 than in all but one of those 42 months. And so I think, like, the pull the ball in the air more is a classic, like, argument we've heard this year about the Blue Jays, and I understand it. But, like, sometimes it makes me kind of, it kind of confuses me, because I'm just like, well, do you just want more home runs? Because, like, yeah, we all want to see more home runs, but just trying to pull any ball in the air more, it's way too broad and general of a statement when talking about a team, a player, or anything. Like, and what you saw when I looked at all of those pulled balls in the air for Springer in July, you know, it was pulling outside fastballs. It was being out on your front foot and trying to flip the bat to pull a breaking ball. You know, and those things wind up being, even if you kind of barrel it, it ends up being like you're losing distance, and they end up being warning track fly balls, and they end up being lazy fly balls to the left fielder. So I don't think that's good process. Now, if you're telling me, no, we want you to drive the ball, then yeah, I'm all for balls that go 420 that are pulled. No one's against those. But so what we saw in August was he got timed up properly to fastballs. He was thinking big part of the field, and a lot of those hits are right side, up the middle, stuff like that. So I like that process. I don't think it's a process that he's going to stick with throughout, but for a way to get out of a slump, I love the logic of it.
And it's worth noting too that on the season as a whole, July, obviously he got out of what had made him effective, and he wasn't particularly effective before. But when it comes to, hey, is this guy equipped to apply the approach that you're laying out there, Chris, and be patient and identify and recognize pitches? Well, this is a guy who has a career low swing and miss rate right now, and has always been a guy who doesn't chase a ton outside of the zone. He's chasing less now than he has since Houston. So those things tell me that this is someone who recognizes pitches well and is comfortable, you know, taking the right pitches and waiting. It's just a matter of, yeah, you got to find your way to a few more fastballs. He's seeing fewer fastballs than at any point in his career. So that the stat you mentioned with pitchers challenging him more, they're also challenging him more with breaking stuff and off-speed stuff in the zone. So we'll see how this is going to be a fun ebb and flow to see over the rest of the year, where George Springer has shown an ability to be disciplined, stick to that approach, wait on fastballs. But pitchers have tried as much as they can. Now, you can't just abandon fastballs entirely, but they've tried to get away from that and attack him early in counts with breaking and off-speed stuff in the zone. So it's going to be an interesting cat and mouse here as we go. I'm thinking specifically if the Jays end up in a wild card game against the Houston Astros, given some of what you've laid out in the past with the Astros and Bo Bichette, and obviously the Astros' familiarity with George Springer. Should be fun to watch to see how this continues to develop. Tonight, we're going to see Zach Wheeler on the hill for the Phillies. Now, he's someone who is probably going to be comfortable challenging George Springer however he wants, because Zach Wheeler has a lot of ways to attack guys. He throws six different pitches, five if you don't believe the changeup is an actual pitch that he mixes in there, because he's only thrown a handful of them on the season. But Zach Wheeler is a guy who, this is a quote unquote down year for him, and his ERA is sub four, and he's been out there pretty much every time through the order. He gave the Blue Jays fits when he saw them earlier in the year. He gave them four really good innings late in September last year when he was just fresh off the IL. What do you like about Zach Wheeler's game, and what are you looking for tonight for the Jays?
Zach Wheeler's command is like elite, 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 elite. He's a fun guy to watch. We dove into his stuff during the playoffs in the past couple of years a little bit. And he's just one of those guys where when you look at the heat maps of his pitches, they're beautiful. Like the red is all near the edges. You look out, like when he paints sinkers, they're beautiful. And they just, he can put his breaking balls exactly where he wants to. It's one of those guys who's a pleasure to watch. It's an Estrada Ryu type of command, but with also elite stuff, which makes him a super hard combination. To me, based on what I said there about being able to paint and put the ball exactly where he can, this dives back to kind of what I was saying about Springer. Like, it's interesting hunting. Siddle and I were talking about this the other day when we were catching up. When you're hunting fastballs, sometimes it allows you to lay off, depending on the location, but actually it ties back to kind of the pulling the ball in the air thing, where if you're thinking, I need to pull the ball, that's where you start to see the chasing on the breaking balls down and away. Like, those two processes are kind of tied together. And sometimes trying to swing your way out of a slump, trying to fix wrist struggles all in one plate appearance, trying to do all that stuff, that's what makes you susceptible to all that chase we were talking about. And like, the good approaches that can kind of infuriate Jays fans sometimes, I think what that does is it allows you to lay off some of this stuff. So like Wheeler, to me, it's a simple approach that you need to approach him with. If you get a mistake, if you get a hanging breaking ball middle, then yeah, by all means, get the front foot down and rip it. But you really need to be you need to dial down what you're trying to do when you face a good pitcher like this, a really good pitcher like this. So it's always fun to watch these battles. And it's, you know, it's the other thing that I like about these schedules where you're seeing different teams. All like, I'm going to Cincinnati on Thursday or Friday, and I'm really excited to see that team for a whole variety of reasons. But like, it's cool that we get to see different teams equally. It feels more like an NBA season this year than the way the baseball seasons have felt, where it seems like you're facing the Rays or the Orioles all the time. So kind of cool that we get to see, you know, the best pitchers in the game, best hitters of the game so often.
Yeah, no big deal. You get to go down to Cincinnati for the weekend. Whatever. Whatever, Chris. It's fine. You just go hang out with Joey Votto.
My wife is not happy.
Go hang out with Joey Votto. Oh, yeah. Coming off of like 2 weeks in Montreal doing 15-hour days, I bet that, yeah, you raising your hand for the Cincinnati assignment wasn't a popular one. With respect to Wheeler, good luck to Blue Jays righties, because that sweeper's been deadly this year. And even if you do sit fastball, you're talking about 96 if it's the four-seamer, and a sinker at 95 that is going to run in on your hands and is a ground ball machine. So best of luck to those Blue Jays. Chris, before we let you go here, we are anticipating Jordan Romano will be activated tonight. He had a rehab inning on Saturday at AAA Buffalo. Obviously, the back issues that he was dealing with in his last outing, we saw that was very plainly affecting the command of the fastball before he was taken out of that game. What are you looking for from Jordan Romano to let you know he's right, or was there anything, you know, on the radar before he hit the IL for you at all anyway?
Not really. Like you mentioned, you hit off the top, like his command wasn't the best. And when he's right, like Romano's an elite command guy, and you know, he can paint the slider. He can work the fastball where he wants to within a certain range. So to me, what stands out about Romano going on the IL and getting right was that they had the runway and the ability to do so, and not, you know, not totally go in the tank. And I feel like that's just a testament to the Hicks acquisition. I know there have been some hiccups of late, but to me, Romano going on the IL, being able to withstand it, that just speaks to the bullpen depth and the fact that they've been able to withstand it. Now we can come back, slot some guys into better spots. I think it's just better. And I think it's going to be good to see the bullpen at full throttle again, because I really like how the pieces fit together when you see them all ready to go, all pitching where they should be pitching.
And that is, we assume, Romano taking back the ninth, but some of the mix and match we saw with Swanson, Hicks, and Meza over 7-8-9 the last couple of weeks can now be over even 6-7-8 or just 7-8, and you keep those guys a little better rested. Chris Black, thanks for taking the time out, man. Enjoy Cincinnati. I have heard that Skyline Chili is a little overrated. I thought it was fine, but yeah, I don't know. Maybe you can report back on that for us.
I just want to see De La Cruz in person.
You are not, you don't care about Cincinnati style chili.
No, not at all. Just going to be, there's not a lot of for me personally, I'm so tired when I'm working on the road. Food, it's about proximity to where I am. Minimal steps, minimal time spent. So if you're close to the park, that's where I'm probably going to be.
Well, Ellie De La Cruz and the Cincinnati Reds have cooled off pretty dramatically, but still a lot of fun and still in a playoff race. So that'll be a tough three set this weekend, tough two set down at Rogers Center. Chris Black, hope you enjoy it. Hope you get a little bit of breathing time here before you take off to Cincinnati.
Thanks, buddy. Talk to you soon.
Chris Black, producer at Sportsnet, at Down to Black on Twitter. Keep an eye out for his Twitter account for more detail on that Hyunjin Ryu sinker that Chris told us about there. He'll have a thread out on that a little later. And of course, we'll keep an eye on it next time Hyunjin Ryu takes the mound, which we don't know specifically when that is. The Jays have only announced that it's Kikuchi and Gausman for this two-game set. If everyone just next man ups it, it would be Berríos, Bassett, Ryu in Cincinnati. We assume anyway we will see those three guys in some order, which then sets the Blue Jays up fairly nicely to have Kikuchi and Gausman start the first two games against the Orioles next week. That's still, you know, assuming things go reasonably well over these five games, that's still a pretty important series for any hopes of winning the American League East. And I think it's an interesting note that it would be Kikuchi Gausman starting that one off. Maybe they juggled the order or something like that, but the way things line up, because yeah, I think Baltimore is one of the matchups that if you're looking ahead to who you'd start of the five starters in a playoff series or in a wild card game or something like that, the Orioles are a team that skews a little lefty heavy in a ballpark that suppresses right-handed hitter power. That to me is a Kikuchi matchup more than maybe any other team you could see in the American League playoffs. Houston, I think, would probably be at the bottom of the Kikuchi matchup, just given that they are very heavy on righties and heavy on righty power. So that'll be something fun to watch over these next 6-7 weeks or so as we get ready for, we hope, playoff baseball, with the assist from Samad Taylor last night, making that slightly more likely. The Fangraphs playoff odds currently giving the Blue Jays a 68.7% chance to make the playoffs. Yusei Kikuchi's been a big part of that. Michael Bauman of Fangraphs wrote about Yusei Kikuchi last week. Let's take a break. Let's talk to Michael next on Jays Talk Plus on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Smart takes on the biggest stories in sports. The Fan Drive Time with Ben Ennis. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Yusei Kikuchi taking the hill tonight against the Philadelphia Phillies. A gentleman who knows a little something about both of those things is Michael Bauman of Fangraphs. Michael, how are you? Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I am excellent. I got to ask you, before we talk Phillies Jays, why is the SEC trying to ruin college sports, and why are you so in favor of it?
Well, I mean, as a proud proud-ish anymore, South Carolina grad, I think everybody else needs to get less broke if they don't want the SEC to rule college sports. But I wrote about this at great length on Fangraphs on Monday. So if you want to know how conference realignment is shaping the future of college baseball, please read that.
Yes.
So thanks for giving me the chance to plug that.
Please do. It's a lot to sort through, honestly. The Pac-12 dying as it is, and the kind of power struggle with the SEC at the very tippy top of it. So definitely go there, read a little bit more. It'll definitely have an impact on future draft classes and things like that. Michael, it's been a busy time around the Philadelphia Phillies coming out of the trade deadline here. There's obviously the Michael Lorenzen cool debut and the no-hitter, but also, did we find out that Aubrey Plaza is low-key a Philly super fan?
Well, I found that out. I think that was common knowledge to begin with.
I didn't know that either until you pointed it out.
Yeah, I pointed that out, and then I got a lot of people in my mention saying, didn't you know that Aubrey Plaza was from Delaware? I was like, no. I watch Parks and Rec, but I would say there are definitely people who are more interested in her than I am. But it's always interesting to find out that I don't know what the Canadian equivalent of being from Delaware is, but it's weird.
I think Canadian.
Is it?
Like, I mean, it's like Canada is like Toronto, Vancouver, Montreal, and then everywhere else would be a Delaware. And I don't mean to disparage any of those other places. Just, the population wise, we're pretty heavily concentrated to a couple spots here.
Yeah. So, this is like very small Manitoba or something.
There you go.
I don't know.
Yeah, Winnipeg. You get your odd Chris Jericho or Rowdy Roddy Piper from there, but that's about it. Okay, so in seriousness, the Phillies have, turned it on a little bit here since the deadline. Took a couple against the Royals, had a really good series against the Nationals, maybe a little less so on the weekend after that big outburst against the Twins, but generally speaking, things seem to be going in the right direction, and they are a team somewhat similar to the Blue Jays, where at least offensively, we've all been waiting for things to click and for guys to start playing as we expect them to play. The Phillies being in a playoff position here, having a couple games of edge in the wild card, being so far behind the Braves, where are you at just in terms of where this Phillies team stacks up and, where the, obviously the focus needs to be on being the best in October, but more specifically where you're looking for signs that this Phillies team could be a threat in the playoffs?
Well, I think that's where what they've done over the past week or so has come in. The I guess, headline thing about this team was supposed to be the hitting for power, and Bryce Harper has not done that this season. You know, Trey Turner struggles have been well documented. Kyle Schwarber's, you know, run hot and cold. What has kept this team afloat has been one of the best pitching staffs in baseball, and I think that's always been underrated about this team. But they had a great rotation to begin with. That was aided by the emergence of Chris Sanchez. I think it's a legit MLB starter, and now the acquisition of Mike Lorenzen, who's been incredible since the trade. And now in the past week or two, Turner's gotten hot. Schwarber's really turned it on. And that's even, you know, Bryce Harper's sort of day-to-day with a bat thing right now. Brandon Marsh is on the IL. So things are not completely clicking yet, but once the offense gets going, I think this is a really dangerous team that's really well-built for October. And I think having a couple games worth of cushion will do this team a world of good, because they've got a lot of guys, I think up to and including Harper, who I'm going to say this and it's going to sound like something other than what I mean. They tend to try too hard when things aren't going well. Mm. And so just having the ability to, you know, it's, and we see, you know, that can be good or bad. You know, we see how well these guys played in the playoffs last year. But just being able to calm down and sort of let the game come to them, which they will be able to do if they maintain this lead in the wild card. And I'm not really inspired by a lot of the teams that are chasing them, to be completely honest. I think we'll see this team continue to round into form at the right time. So, you know, and some of that, you know, I'll be completely honest, they played a really weak schedule last week. They beat up on a lot of bad teams, but also that's what you have to do. So I think that this will be, you know, this test against Toronto will be a good look into what we can expect from them.
Yeah, and there, look, in what you just said there are some real similarities to what the Blue Jays have gone through. A pitching staff that has done everything they can to keep them in it. A bunch of hitters who are under, maybe not disaster seasons, but underperforming where we expected. And yeah, you talk about trying to do too much. These two teams ranked 23rd and 24th respectively, hitting with runners in scoring position by weighted runs created plus. So good offensive teams that otherwise struggle in big spots. When you look at, you mentioned Sanchez there and him emerging as a legitimate major league starter. The Phillies have decided here for this next little stretch, at least, to turn to a 6-man rotation. Now, we know that that's aimed at things like, hey, let's make sure everyone's in good shape come October. There is a Taijuan Walker component to that. There is Michael Lorenzen having just thrown infinity pitches to get a no hitter. What do you like, or where are your concerns about turning to a 6-man for the next little bit here for Philly?
Well, I like it because it's something that they can sort of dial up and down, because not just Sanchez, but Lorenzen has recent, and Ranger Suarez too, for that matter, has recent experience being sort of like a multi-inning relief guy. You know, I think the smart thing about the 6-man rotation is you look at what happened to them down the stretch last year, and it's interesting we see this every World Series, that there are pitchers who have been lights out all playoffs, and then like, it's literally game 6 or 7 of the World Series where they just completely run out of gas, where it's just too much. And that happened to Zach Wheeler last year. So I wonder if some of this is to take maybe 5% of the workload off of guys like Wheeler and Nola, who they're going to need if they're going to make another run to October. You know, it allows them to keep Sanchez in the rotation, keep his confidence up. You know, it allows them to maybe take a little bit of heat off of Suarez and Taijuan Walker, who've dealt with, you know, sort of minor injuries throughout the season. So if you have that kind of depth, I think that's a smart thing to do. We'll see how long they stick with it, though.
What did you make of Zach Wheeler's comments about, like, hey, man, I don't really like this. My ERA is way better when I'm on normal rest. And I'm paraphrasing here, but his ERA is almost a run better on normal rest versus extra rest. But there is that component of, yeah, you ran out of gas a little bit last year, and he'd had the IL stint last year, too. So maybe wasn't 1,000%. But a guy like Wheeler, and we've heard similar from Chris Bassitt here in Toronto, where, yeah, he's been pretty honest about the toll of the Jays first going to a 4-man rotation for a bit and then to a 6-man rotation. Wheeler in particular, what do you make of his thoughts that he'd rather be, and now I'm quoting directly, 80% on 4 days rest versus a little better rested but not in his routine?
So nobody loves routine more than starting pitchers.
Yes.
You know, they're like cats in that respect. Like if anything is off, you know, you're going to hear about it. And so I understand where he's coming from. And I think that, you know, that's an important factor to put into, or an important bit of information to factor into this decision. But at the same time, you used to hear the same thing about the shift. You know, you get guys who, pitchers who just refuse to pitch in front of the shift, and they would watch as long as, you know, 5 ground balls got through the normal defensive alignment, they were fine. But if one got through the shift, it would just completely throw off their swerve. What I'll say to that is that Rob Thompson, the Phillies manager, his big strength is keeping everybody on side. And, you know, I don't think it's a bad thing that Wheeler's speaking his mind about this, as long as he just goes out there when he's told to and pitches well. And I think that's one of Thompson's strengths, is getting everybody to buy into what the team is doing. You know, we see this in comparison to maybe somebody like Aaron Boone, who struggled to do that in the past few playoffs with his pitchers. So, you know, I think the important thing is they're not going to go to a 6-man rotation in the playoffs. And if they do start to lose ground against teams like the Marlins, they're obviously going to go back and throw Wheeler more. So this is just something they're taking the foot off the gas a little bit while they think they can get away with it. And once crunch time comes, Wheeler's going to have more innings than he knows what to do with, I'm sure.
And he's been, just about the most consistent and reliable pitcher in baseball over the last 4 years or so since signing there. So nobody, very few guys you'd be ready to trust more with that than Zach Wheeler. So the Jays were operating 6-man rotation themselves. Initially, when we line that up here, we thought, it was a real question about who would come out of that rotation when they were done the 17 games in 17 days stretch. Hyunjin Ryu just coming back. Maybe he's not a 1,000%. Alek Manoah coming back from his stint in the minors. Maybe things would click and he'd get right. And maybe Yusei Kikuchi will do what he did last year, go to the pen like you're talking about with guys like Sanchez and Suarez and Lorenzen, who have so much playoff utility if they can comfortably move to the pen and give you a couple innings. But it turns out Kikuchi's just been too damn good for that and has really established himself in this Blue Jays rotation. He is someone you wrote about at FanGraphs last week, a piece called Yusei Kikuchi is keeping the ball in the yard for a change. I have a couple things I'd love to ask you from that piece, but at the highest level, what has stood out to you most about Yusei Kikuchi's turnaround here in 2023 and especially lately?
Yeah, so this first season in Toronto, this piece actually came out of the last time we talked. I was a couple days later, I was looking for something to write about, and I was like, I didn't have a great answer when you asked me about that, so I'm going to figure out what's actually going on. I guess the moral of that story is I take requests. But Kikuchi was doing the two things you don't want to do as a pitcher. He's walking guys and giving up home runs. And that's, FIP, which goes into our version of WAR, is very concerned with those very basic things, the two things you want to avoid at all costs. And Kikuchi was doing them more than any other starting pitcher in baseball, in some cases by a huge margin. And now he's got the walks under control, and I think it's like 5 starts in a row now he hasn't allowed a home run, which is shocking, for what he was doing as recently as this spring. So I dived into how his pitch usage has changed, his release point a little bit, and what he's doing is throwing 2 distinct flavors of breaking ball. And this is a guy who changes his repertoire year to year. I'd say more than most pitchers in baseball, maybe not more than any. And what he's got this year is a hard upper 80s slider and a slow lower 80s curveball. And this is different from the sliders and curve. Both of these pitchers are different from the sliders and curveballs he's thrown in the past. And he's just getting a lot more pop-ups. He's getting a lot more weak contact of guys getting under the ball. This is something that you don't think of pitchers using breaking balls to induce weak contact in the air. We think of inducing weak contact as like a 2-seam or sinker changeup thing, and you try to get it on the ground. And if you try to get pop-ups, that's a lot of fastballs up in the zone. And this is something that we're seeing. We're learning you can get away with this. I wrote about Andrew Abbott from the Reds a couple weeks ago doing the same thing. Using his breaking pitches to get weak contact in the air. And that's a lot of what Kikuchi's doing. I won't read the charts that I put in there on the radio, but basically he's getting, hitters are getting under the ball about a quarter of the time this season, which is just a huge huge upgrade from what he was doing as recently as earlier this season. You can see the home run rate, the hard hit rate on fly balls declining month by month. And so I couldn't identify like a pitch usage thing that changed around the end of May when this hot streak really started. You know, I just wonder if this is just him developing that repertoire early in the season and finally getting comfortable with it, learning how to execute it, or if it's something else that doesn't show up in the underlying numbers. But he's definitely a different pitcher to what he was last year.
Certainly. And you look, if we look at the monthly trends and things like that, the way you cut it up with the lack of hard hit in the air, if we want to use FIP, which is the home run strikeout walk focus one, if we want to use expected ERA, which is the Statcast one that takes a little more hard hit and things like that into account, they have all trended pretty consistently and pretty uniformly in the right direction. So some room for confidence there. Michael, before I let you go here, I wanted to ask you about one other one that you wrote about recently, and it's not Jays Phillies related, but it is germane to the American League playoff situation. Shane McClanahan potentially done for the year. The Rays have come back down to earth over the last couple of months as it is. They had cooled off dramatically offensively, and now they lose one of their most important pitchers in a staff that already didn't have a lot because of injuries, and even after the Aaron Civale acquisition. Do the Rays have enough here? They're probably going to make the playoffs just by how big a margin they have, but come playoff time, how big a hit is the McClanahan injury to any confidence you had in the Rays?
It's big. No team is going to lose basically their best starting pitcher and just keep on ticking over. It's huge. But the Rays, this is something the Rays have dealt with before, and that was sort of the thrust of my article. They are very good at developing pitchers, but those pitchers tend to get hurt a lot. They get road hardened, put away wet. And that, there are things you can do to pitchers that take a toll on them other than running up huge innings counts. And so they've had to deal with this with Blake Snell, with Tyler Glasnow, with Yanni Chirinos, Shane Babbs, who's on the IL recovering from Tommy John surgery from last September. So they can pitch around it. They still have Aaron Civale, like you said. Zach Eflin, ex-Philly, has been outstanding this season. He avoided a minor injury scare. Glasnow's back and pitching well. So they can weather this. It's just going to be tough. And now, we all are not really sure how to talk about the Wander Franco situation, but that's another thing that's, if you just want to look at on-field impact, like, he's one of their best hitters. And so they were trending in the wrong direction to begin with, and now these things coming one by one. I think that, this is still a really good team. It still has enough starting pitching and a savvy manager that can conjure innings out of these guys. So I think they're still dangerous, but it's hard to, I don't know how you look at this as anything but a huge negative.
Yeah, it's unfortunate for the pitching side of that. And Wander Franco, of course, placed on the restricted list by Tampa Bay yesterday, and we'll continue to monitor that one. Michael Bauman, thank you so much for taking the time out this morning. Keep up all the great work at Fangraphs.
All right, thank you.
Michael Bauman of Fangraphs. You can go check that Yusei Kikuchi piece out. Check out all his great work. If you are at all interested in college baseball or even the impact that things like conference realignment will have on how we draft prospects and how I'd imagine prospects will be heavily concentrated to power conferences, a couple of pieces there worth a look. The Pac-12 is dying. What does that mean for college baseball? Again, the Kikuchi piece as well. Some stuff on McClanahan and the Rays rotation question marks headed into the playoffs, in addition to the other Rays question marks right now that we will let the process play out on. But Wander Franco on the restricted list until further notice. Jays Phillies tonight. It's Zach Wheeler against Yusei Kikuchi down at the ballpark. 7 p.m. start. I'll be on the call with Ben Shulman if you're listening on the radio side. TV side has it for you as usual. Reminder that tomorrow's TV broadcast will also be the annual Sportsnet Jays Care broadcast auction presented by TD. So lots to bid on, and as we raise money for the Jays Care Foundation there. So keep an eye out on social media, on the television broadcast, things like that for more details there. Marchese and McKee are coming up next. Blair and Barker have you 5 to 7 if you need a little bit more Jays Phillies tee up. They'll also have Jays talk for you post game. Thanks to Caitlin McGrath, Chris Black, Michael Bauman, Jonathan Mayo for coming on today, to Jeff, Lance, and Jennifer behind the glass. This should be a fun one. I haven't done a game down at the park in a little bit here, so hopefully the sun sneaks out and we get an open dome. I'm going to be selfish and wish that for myself. I think we'll also get a flurry of Blue Jays updates a little later as well. Chapman and Jansen have been banged up. Get the extra day off. Jordan Romano potentially back tonight. Kevin Kiermaier, Trevor Richards, Bo Bichette all inching closer to their returns. Whether that's today, whether that's Friday, whether that's next week for the Baltimore Orioles. The Jays using these three off days in an eight-day stretch to get a little healthier. Pivot back to a five-man rotation. The ace, Yusei Kikuchi, gets it started tonight at Rogers Center. We'll talk to you at 10 a.m. tomorrow on Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.